It's a great pleasure for me to be here today. Thank you for inviting me to Ledbury. But a special honor to read with Salima Hill, whose poems I've admired for so many years and met in books, but never before. Sometimes you hear a phrase again and again, and it makes a kind of a rhythm that sticks in your head. That's what happened to me when I heard the same phrase on television and in news reports, and it's a phrase that seems to have stuck in the throat of the English language. The whole first part of this poem is made up of things that people actually said, just rearranged a little. Speech balloon. The Liverpool boss was pretty chuffed with himself, said the news report, for being so tough, when he decided to snub the obvious choice and go instead for the goal machine. I'm over the moon, they said, he said. I'm over the moon, he said. The Barnsley manager was lost for words to describe his feelings when Chelsea fell to the Tykes. We played fantastic. I never thought we'd do it again, but we did. And all I can say is, I'm over the moon, they said, he said. I'm over the moon, he said. The Hollywood mum was way beyond thrilled, according to friends, when she delivered into the world not one bouncing baby, but twins instead, to the astonished dad. And I'm over the moon, they said, she said. I'm over the moon, she said. Bollywood's hottest couple was proud to be blessed by the jubilant father, the superstar. It's a match made in heaven, he said to the press, between two shooting stars with shining careers. And I'm over the moon, they said, he said. I'm over the moon, he said. The Malaysian nation went mad with joy on Independence Day in its 50th year when a doctor-come-part-time model, a local boy, went up into space in a Russian Soyuz and in zero gravity performed his namaz. All of Malaysia over the moon, they said on the news. 27 million people over the moon. You must have noticed. It's really quite clear. This condition has spread. It's happening there. It's happening here. It's full-blown, grown beyond every border to the furthest corner of every country where English is spoken or English is known. There's no one just satisfied or mildly pleased or chipper or chirpy, contented or cheerful. No one glad or gratified, delighted or jubilant, elated, ecstatic, joyful or gleeful. All the happy people have left this world. You won't come across them anytime soon. And if it's happy sound bites you're looking for, you need to look way over your head for the words and balloons to the place where the cow keeps jumping over and over with all the footballers, team managers and lottery winners, world superstars, heroes and champions and legends and lovers and proud mums and dads. And the whole of Malaysia, over the moon, over the moon, over the moon. Thank you. Not long ago, the ceiling of the house I lived in Bombay fell down. To me, it didn't look like a bad thing. It looked as if maybe that ceiling and those walls needed to come down, as if the room was trying to tell me something. And so I gave away everything that I owned in the room, tables, chairs, clothes, ring, jewelry, wedding ring. And what I was left with was this poem. This room is breaking out of itself, cracking through its own walls in search of space, light, empty air. The bed is lifting out of its nightmares. From dark corners, chairs are rising up to crash through clouds. This is the time and place to be alive, when the daily furniture of our lives stirs, when the improbable arrives. Pots and pans bang together in celebration, clang past the crowd of garlic, onions, spices, fly by the ceiling fan. No one's looking for the door. In all this excitement, I'm wondering where I've left my feet and why my hands are outside clapping. Thank you. The next poem, I began writing this because of something that happened in Lahore in the last year of the 20th century. A woman was shot by her family in her lawyer's office, and her crime was that she'd asked for a divorce. And at the time, the whole Pakistan Senate refused to condemn the act because they called it an honor killing. That kind of injustice is going on every day. Honor killing. At last, I'm taking off this coat, this black coat of a country that I swore for years was mine, that I wore more out of habit than design. Born wearing it, I believed I had no choice. I'm taking off this veil, this black veil of a faith that made me faithless to myself, that tied my mouth, gave my God a devil's face, and muffled my own voice. I'm taking off these silks, these lacy things that feed dictator dreams, the Mangal Sutra and the rings rattling in a tin cup of needs that beggared me. I'm taking off the skin and then the face, the flesh, the womb. Let's see what I am in here. When I squeeze past the easy cage of bone, let's see what I am out here, making, crafting, plotting at my new geography. The last couple of poems were old poems, but this is one that's from the new book, Over the Moon. And this is called, well, there's a phrase in India, we are like that only. And it's a phrase that's used to, I see some nods, people who know India. It's a phrase that's used to excuse a multitude of shortcomings, some large and some small, mostly large. So this is called Like That Only for Simon. At the sign of the black flip-flop crossed off in red, by the door of the Ganesh temple, you're obliged to take off your shoes, and this you do. In the face of all the silent watchers on the steps, you bend, struggle to undo the laces, and come up pink, not as a stranger might think out of embarrassment. No, you point at your foot in its black sock, and there, escaping it, the pale slug of your naked toe. You laugh because you know, as all the watchers do, that this is the way of things. A sock inside a shoe is deemed immaculate. A sock exposed to public view, especially on its way to God, will grow a hole. Even the master of symmetry knew this to be true. When Gabriel and the dove fly in, the fabric of the day wears thin and frays around the Virgin's face. Light folds itself over a boy's head, and he is shirtless, shivering, but believes the Baptist will turn from the main event before too long to tend to him. So you make a kind of offering of frailty, an opening for the world to show its grace. And as you point, the watchers, children, street dogs, bottom scratchers become your family. You are a foreigner nowhere. On imperfect feet, you go in to meet the gods, the open-armed, the many-eyed, the asymmetric, belly-shaking gods. Thank you. The next one's called Taal, and in Sanskrit it means a clap or a beat. And I was thinking about the rhythmic beat that's used to keep time with a Kathak dancer. If you drew the movement of the dancer's feet, you'd see it's from a point and it's a circular movement that keeps coming back to the same point. It's like a pulse moving out from the center and back. And for me it changed in some ways the idea of keeping time. It was as if you could have that time was on a loop. You could loop it and hold time as if all times could begin to coexist. And between the beat, there's also the Kali, the space between the beats. And that's indicated by a sideways sweep of the hand when the singer sings the tal, it performs the tal. Tal. This music will not sit in straight lines. The notes refuse to perch on wires, but move in rhythm with the dancer round the face of the clock through the dandelion head of time. We feel blown free, but circle back to be in love, to touch and part and meet again, spun past the face of the moon, the precise underpinning of stars. The cycle begins with one and ends with one. Da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da. There must be other feet in step with us, an underbeat, a voice that keeps count, not yours or mine. This music is playing us. We are playing with time. Thank you. And in a time when so many things seem to be lost or about to be lost, there's one thing that never is lost, and that is the Bombay Tiffin Box. Some people may not know about the Tiffin Box. Every working day, hundreds of thousands of office workers across the city have their food delivered to them. It's made at home and delivered by the Dabbawalas, the Tiffin Box carriers. There's no name or address on the box. It's just a tiny mark. In spite of that, in a city of more than 19 million, only one box in 8 million is ever lost. I thought that deserved a poem. And the poem's written in the voice of the Tiffin Box. It's a voice that uses English, abused, misused, turned inside out, but used unapologetically, because that's how English has evolved now all over the world. And of course, as we know, English is now just one more Indian language. Dabba's dialogue, or Tiffin Box talks. No place for words, yar. Alphabet? Forget. Zara no space on my lid for commonplace. No good name, no home address, no reference number. Tucked in our tin tin, in VT station, off the local train. All world over knows me by my fame and my lid sign. I arrive before wheels squeal on the track only. 11 o'clock, exact. On the spot, on the dot, tucked in our tin tin, Dabba comes in. No sala. Sala is an interesting word. In most Indian languages, it means brother-in-law. But it's also commonly used as a swear word. No sala can break this our momentum. Dabbawalas, Dabbas, handcarts, running in formation through chaos. Patafat, all clatter and hustle. Tiffin Box will reach on the dot, on the spot. Outside the lift, on the exact floor, where at tiffin time, Seema, Geronimo, Sunil, Patil, Swaminathan, Iyer are expecting for food hot from the hand of Ma and Mrs. Home Kitchen. No need for words, ya. No need to speak only. When dal roti, raita, rice, bindi, bengan, potato and pickle, home food, comes damadam in three tiers of a tiffin. No need for love notes, yeah. This affair is carrying on for 100 years. Own home in a tin with a kiss on the lid, delivered by a man who never mastered ABC but reads me like his Mrs. face. Then happiness becomes.
Glasses. Salima Hill grew up in a family of painters in farms in England and Wales and has lived in Dorset for the past 35 years. She's published numerous books of poetry. Her earlier work is collected in her Luddax retrospective Gloria, which came out in 2008. Her latest collection, Jutland, is her 16th book of poetry. and her 13th with Bloodaxe. Now, latterly, Bloodaxe has been publishing a new collection by her every year, each of these containing a number of sequences. And we've been able to persuade her to leave the beautiful Dorset coast to give just one reading per year from each book. Now, last year, she ventured to Aldborough to read from that year's collection, The Sparkling Jewel of Naturism. And this year, Ledbury has the honour of hosting her only reading from Jutland, which was recently shortlisted for the Roehampton Poetry Prize. Now, Jutland brings together two contrasting poem sequences, Advice on Wearing Animal Prints and Sunday Afternoons at the Gravel Pits. And like all of her work, both sequences chart what Darren Rees-Jones has called extreme experience with dazzling excess, and with startling humour and a surprising combinations of homely and outlandish. Jutland poses questions about forgiveness. Quote, but the answers, like Valentine's, are never enough, she writes in a poem called Wolverine. And can't he understand? I'm trying to love him, but I don't know how. And is it true forgiveness is forgiveness, only if the person first repents? That kindness isn't kindness, but self-sacrifice. Now, the poems are very short. They're also disturbing, but very funny at the same time. And they make you laugh, and then they make you feel uncomfortable at having just laughed, but that's part of the power of them, part of how they work. And they're very short, and they form these two long sequences. So I would say in relation to the reading, it's best not to clap after each one, because otherwise we'll have more clapping than poems. So save all your clapping for the end of Salima's reading, and then we get these pregnant pauses between each of them, which I think you need to actually absorb the nature of what you've just heard. So would you please welcome Salima Hill.
Hello. First of all, let's start with poetry's protest. English Pen and Ledbury, as I'm sure you know, are running a poetry's protest campaign to highlight the cases and writings of some of the many poets at risk around the world. Susana Chavez Castillo, from Mexico, who was tragically murdered in 2011, is one such poet. I apologize, I can't pronounce her name, and also I apologize that I don't know the name of the translator. Our Blood. This is Susana Chavez Castillo's poem, Our Blood. Blood of my own, blood of sunrise, blood of a broken moon, blood of silence, of dead rock, of a woman in bed jumping into nothingness, open to the madness. Blood clear and definite, fertile seed, blood the unbelievable journey, blood as its own liberation, blood river of my songs, sea of my abyss, blood, painful moment of my birth, nourished by my last appearance. It's not easy to go from one to the other, to my own work. But here goes. Once a year. So I'd like to thank Neil, who hates being thanked, for letting me read once a year. And I was so happy, but it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. It doesn't work that way because it means I just dread for a whole year instead of dreading in little sections. And when I told my son, who may or may not be here, how happy I was. He said, well, Neil's probably just wanting to shut me up and because I do more harm than good.
Cheers, son.
Not true. Thank you, Neil. Yeah, so I was also, a year gives me long enough to think of excuses. So when it was really hot about 2 weeks ago, I was swimming and I was thinking, yes, the train tracks, may the train tracks between Exeter and Ledbury buckle, or may the train tracks throughout England and Wales buckle so that Philippa would ring me up and say that it was cancelled. But that didn't happen. But when I was swimming, this is really true, I felt something in my arm and I was stung by a jellyfish. Can you believe it? And so as I was going to the doctor, I was so happy. And I was like, hello, Philippa, this is Salima Hill. I'm due to read on Saturday, but I'm really sorry I can't come because I've been stung by a jellyfish. But it's really almost gone now, so I'm not at all ill, so here I am. I'll read from Jutland, which is a draft horse. Jutland is a draft horse, which hasn't got much relevance to my reading, but I do like spondees. And to annoy myself, my next collections aren't spondees. My next collections are called The Magnitude of My Sublime Existence, and the one after that is called Buttercup the Sloth. And this one, one of the reasons I don't like doing readings, this might sound rather tactless, but I don't like doing them, and one of the many reasons is because I know you're not idiots, but it's as if my voice, it's me. Do you understand what I mean? But it's not. And also I don't like doing readings because you spend years and years getting the punctuation right and the look on the page right or visually, and then that's just like pearls or, I don't know, it's wasted. So they, as Neil said, they look very small. So thank you, Neil, for my space at the bottom, which I love. But they were very long, by the way, in case you think that I can only write short poems. I go on and on and on and on and on, and then I have to put them in a drawer for a month just to make sure that that I cut them down again. So then I usually cut about three quarters of them and start three quarters of the way down, and then I cut the bottom, so I'm left with about two lines, and then I kind of spin a more exciting ending than what it had when it had been sitting in the drawer for a month. If people ask me what I like about poetry, I think it's punctuation, and that's another thing that you can't see when I'm reading. My father likes to crush the necks of mice in various traps he sets around the house, mostly in the kitchen, where my mother is candying her candied orange peel. When everybody else is asleep, my father is awake. And what he does, he always does alone and smartly dressed, the way a wolf is smartly dressed in stories. You know, some people say that that poets don't prepare properly, and I think I do because I don't prepare at all. So that means that I'm really thinking about you and what feels right when I'm here. But the drawback of that is sometimes I get to the end and then nothing seems to be really right. And so I will just read the ones which I'm going to read. He's standing by my bed like a cupboard, standing with no face in the dark. But if I start to move, I think the cupboard will suddenly start to move too. The doctor is the man I call the doctor, who creeps around the house like a snail creeping around the house on a foot, capable of everything but sound. My father's chair. I never go towards it. On the contrary, I back away, and then a firm hand guides me from behind until I'm held beside myself with rage between the knees that grip me like a pair of sliding doors nobody can open but the opener. My father's hands, like gold and silver mice that smell of hyacinths in darkened rooms, like wingless lorikeets. His hands advance as if he isn't true, as if he can't do wrong, like the Pope. My father's feet. My father's very proud of his body, and most of all, of the tiny feet he powders every afternoon, like poodles whose whiteness must be whiter than Swan Lake. My father's horse. I should have been a girl he could have raped. I should have been a woman or a horse. I should have been his own private swimming pool. But can't he see I'm not, and I refuse to be? They look short. Never trust a girl who hates her father. Never trust a girl who can swim. Never go alone to the gravel pits with somebody with arms and legs like rubble crushers. The savage girls with shimmering hair who jump so close to where the rocks are I can't look, who know that love is pointless, need to know that if they think I love him, they're mistaken. Like blocks of ice on thickly frozen lakes, creaking as they readjust themselves, my father can be heard behind the door, adjusting to my presence in the bathroom. My father's love. My father thinks he loves me, but he doesn't, or not enough, or in the wrong way. And God himself has told me, in confidence, it's just a waste of everybody's time. Of all the violent girls at the gravel pits, I myself am the most violent, or so my father thinks. But even he has no idea how violent I am, how cold the water, how high-pitched the scream, how close the secret of eternal life. My father's crochet hook. The crochet hook and the sliced lemon, as bright as a rock pool's, used to frighten me because the smell of crab meat made his hands smell of severed hands police might find. Although the bodies of the violent girls that throw themselves against the shimmering lakes may look as hard and glossy as mahogany, they're nowhere near as hard as you might think. My father's smile. Actually, I used to think that I wanted everyone to love me. You know, when I was doing a reading, I was like, love me, please. I think, whatever, just love me. And then I realize now that I don't want that, that my family love me in spite of my work, not because of it. So that might be a bit different. And I don't, funnily enough, even want to be admired exactly. But what I really like is the sense of fellowship and that your readers and probably writers, and it feels really good that you're I may be fantasizing, but that you kind of sense of fellowship really. So I would like to say how grateful I am for being invited here. It's not the absence of love. Oh, also, I just must say that I'm your duck. I wanted to say that I don't know, it might have been Margaret Atwood, but it doesn't sound really characteristic of her. But, you know, I think somebody said about duck pate, and if you like duck pate, you wouldn't necessarily want to go and see the duck. That's somebody being horrible about readings. But so, not only am I your duck, but actually I would prefer to meet the duck than the pate, to be honest. What's wrong with meeting a duck? Neil read the poem that I was going to read. So I won't read that, except that Neil stumbled as I stumbled. Nee. Tongue. First of all, I will forget the tongue. And secondly, I will forget the mouth. And then I will forget the room itself, in which he would secrete me like a cheese. Yesterday, for like a split second, I felt my heart go out to him. I mean, only for a second, which is nothing, but to me, it was like everything. I saw him, or I thought I saw him, shiver as if he was a pool or a whippet.
I'd like to start with a love poem. It's called Undone. That tongue of yours is silver when you speak, and silver when the speaking's done. Those eyes have a look that turns my quick to silver, and proves my body's not my own, but away on loan to your fingers, bold in their skillful wheeling and their dealing. Your mouth the alchemist, I'm gold, blown through the eggshell of the ceiling into a clear Murano sky. All that goes with me is the scent of you, which could be the scent of me, for there is no I or you, flung as we are to glassy blue. See how well I'm undone with one touch of your silenced silver tongue. Growing up in Glasgow, I always felt as if real life was happening somewhere else, in some other country, somewhere where I was not. This is no reflection on Glasgow, of course. It was a great city. It was just a function of being young, I think. In Wales, wanting to be Italian. And you have to excuse my imaginary German. Is there a name for that thing you do when you're young? There must be a word for it in some language, probably German. Or if not, it is just asking to be made up. Something like Fremdlandisch, Gehör and Lust. Or perhaps Ein so Mann das Land, Gehör und Wunsch. What is it called? Living in Glasgow, dying to be French. Dying to shrug and pout and make yourself understood without saying a word. Have you ever felt like that? Being in Bombay, wanting to declare like Freddie Mercury that you are from somewhere like Zanzibar? What is that called? Being 16 in Wales, longing to be Italian, longing to say, to be able to say aloud, without embarrassment, Bella, Bella, lounge by a Vespa, with a cigarette hanging out of your mouth and wear impossibly pointed shoes. One more love poem. Hiraeth, Old Bombay. Hiraeth is one of those almost untranslatable Welsh words that means something in the direction of a longing to return to something that is no longer there. And Bombay, as you know, its name has been changed to Mumbai, because when politicians want to rewrite history, one of the first things they do is change the names of things. Hiraeth, Old Bombay. I would have taken you to the Nas Cafe if it had not shut down. I would have taken you to the Nas Cafe for the best view and the worst food in town. We would have drunk flat beer and cream soda and sweated on plastic chairs at the Nas Cafe. We would have looked down over the dusty trees at cars creeping along Marine Drive round the bay to Eros Cinema and the talk of the town. We would have held hands in the Nas Cafe over sticky rings on the tabletop, knee locked on knee at the Nas Cafe, while we admired the distant stock exchange, Taj Mahal Hotel, Sassoon Dock, Gateway. We would have nursed a drink at the Nas Cafe, and you would have stolen a kiss from me. We would have lingered in the Nas Cafe till the day slid off the map into the Arabian Sea. I would have taken you to Bombay if its name had not slid into the sea. I would have taken you to the place called Bombay, if it were still there, and if you were still here, I would have taken you to the Nas Cafe. I live quite near Smithfield Market, near Farringdon, and there's a point when two things came together. The great boring machines working on Crossrail met at Farringdon under the deep underground. And they all have names, you know, they have names like Victoria and Elizabeth. And while the people were excavating for Crossrail, they discovered under Charterhouse Square bodies laid out in rows, and there were people who had died in the Black Death. For me, those two things came together, waiting for Crossrail. Victoria and Elizabeth, Ada and Phyllis, swoop in from the ends of the earth, of the city to marvel at the newly unearthed find. The tunnel has seen it all before. It yawns, and at its open mouth, these people have materialized, like words it has just spoken, a speech balloon that blossoms out of darkness. The tongue is black and can only stutter, starless. I lived on your street. This baby fed at my breast. We had names. We sat where you sit to drink and eat. Between the city and the pit, the builders and the diggers are speechless, staring into no man's land, its accidental inhabitants written out in rows. The world, the earth knows, the world is many layered and must be used and used again. It throws a blanket over them, but we are the ones who are shivering. We remember their passing as if it were our own. We will always be aware of them, coming and going in our neighborhood. They will be with us, hurrying to the market or standing side by side on the platform, holding hands, hoping we will turn and say their names. They have been here all this time, waiting for our train. The other thing that happens around Smithfield is that at some point the meat market is busy. The men in white coats are busy unloading meat at Smithfield Meat Market. But across the way is a club called Fabric. So you can imagine, at Smithfield, waiting to get in. All these girls are waiting in this city and every city for something to begin, holding their thin arms, hissed at by cars that pass in the rain. They are contained behind the barricade that draws a metal line between them and the freezing vans. At the meat market across the road, busy men in white coats are dancing their daily load of carcasses into patient rows. Later in the night, their coats will be smeared with blood. Later in the night, when sailing by is done and the shipping forecast has begun, thinking of all those souls out in the dark and cold, thinking of the ones alone, the ones lying side by side, holding hands, I remember the young girls who are younger every day, the ragged line they make, how their legs are blue and their faces lit up before they reach the light inside in anticipation of the dance. Medium. All life is out there, spending, spending, spendthrift with its silver like a drunk on moonshine. Across the coffee shop, baristas are calling out to one another in Malayalam. Coffee burbles in Spanish. The streets are a torrent of passing Italian. Windows fly open in Punjabi. Doors bang in Swahili. The school playground is screaming Silethi. Even songbirds are chirping in accents. Valleys, Jordi, Bhojpuri. This upturned glass is mute, but wants to go screeching across the table, its mouth ravenous for word of you. The world is squandering its currency of languages. Save one. Speak to me. Disappeared. That look I recognize. The women's faces have been cut away by scalpels of light, pared so hard the person has disappeared. White forehead, white cheekbones, black holes where the eyes once were. They hold up the photographs of husband, brother, son, the other disappeared. They have turned the faces outward for everyone to see, in case someone witnessed the nudge on the street, or saw them taken aside, or heard the knock on the door, in case there is information. If they are speaking at all, they are saying a name, but all speech is lost in the wailing of sirens. They hold up the faces of family men who have been devoured on the usual road home or been swallowed whole by the exit door. And the photograph is a shield the women wear over the heart, all the brightness turned outward to where no one is looking, really. No one is watching, towards a reason that may not be there, really. A world that might as well have disappeared. More and more, we find civilians in the firing line. And I was thinking about Owen's poems and about the First World War, but this one's called A Century Later. The school bell is a call to battle. Every step to class, a step into the firing line. Here is the target, fine skin at the temple, cheeks still rounded from being 15. Surrendered, surrounded, she takes the bullet in the head and walks on. The missile cuts a pathway in her mind to an orchard in full bloom, a field humming under the sun, its lap open and full of poppies. This girl has won the right to be ordinary, wear bangles to a wedding, paint her fingernails, go to school. Bullet, she says, you are stupid. You have failed. You cannot kill a book or the buzzing in it. A murmur, a swarm. Behind her, one by one, the schoolgirls are standing up to take their places on the front line. Very often people knock technology. But looking at people on the underground, what I feel is when they've got their mobile phones out, I feel that they're carrying with them everyone that they love, their whole world, a whole hinterland of people that they care about. You see them scrolling through the pictures. So this one's called Screensaver. I carry your face in a mobile shrine and take it out on the underground. Your digital eyes look into mine. I change at Farringdon and I have changed. Touched by you, my skin is Kozo tissue. My hair, rose-perfumed ink. My eyelids are gold leaf. The woman on my right, reflected in the window opposite, takes on the stillness of an icon. The boy across the way lifts his cheek to be pure marble, sculpted in living light. Together, we travel on into the night, all of us grown precious, each one of us alive and rare. Litter. At Derby Station, on the pavement where you stood, I leave your shoes. At Sheffield, in the cafe where you sat, I leave the orange scarf. On the Liverpool ferry, I leave your overcoat at the freezing rail where you pointed out Hope Street. On Hope Street, between the two cathedrals, I leave your photograph. On the platform at Euston, your suitcase with green tags. At the front door, I leave grieving. Coming in, I say your name. Saying your name, I bring you home. And the last one I'll read you, because I think you will not be offended if I read this one. is called I Swear. Because I turned up from Bombay too prissy to be rude, because you arrived via Leeds and Burnley, you thought it would do me good to learn some language. So you never just fell, you went arse over tits. And you were never not bothered, you just couldn't be arsed. And when you laughed like an effing drain. And when there was pain, it was a pain in the arse. That was just the start. You taught me all the language you knew, right through the alphabet, from A to Z, from first to last, from bad to worse and worser, and the very worst you could muster. I learned the curses, I learned the cursor. So proper you looked in your nice shoes and suit, and you, until you produced language like magic out of your mouth, and I was impressed. And oh, I fell for you, arse over tits. And when I said so, you laughed like a drain. And we blinded and swore like the daft buggers we were, all the way down Clerkenwell and all the way up on the train to the Horseshoe Pass, and nobody guessed. And I tell you, since you left, it's a pain in the arse. And when some days I feel like shit, or when I say that I feel flat, I swear, I hear you laugh like a drain. Not just flat, missus, flat as a witch's tit. That's what you say, flat as a witch's tit.